NFL football and finances. We got Jed Collins, former Coug, former State, current financial advisor. What do we get into, Big Ben?
Jedzilla will take us through finances, his book, acclaimed author, as well as get into his time with the Saints, the Cougs, how you can make the most of your money, and his podcast, Rookie to Veteran. And that's coming up right now. Why don't we get started here? WSD, your source for West Coast sports. We have Jed Collins. Jed, thanks for joining us.
Hey, pleasure to be on
this Memorial Day weekend. Jed, why don't we start? You're an author, five star, 50 review Amazon author, your money vehicle. Tell us about the book and the purpose behind it.
Absolutely. And it is so neat and weird still for that to be my introduction. You know, for so much of my life, it was like, oh, Jed, big dumb jock, right? The football guy. It's like, all right. It's like, now he wrote something. So your money vehicle. One, I love to call out the intention around the titling. First off, money vehicle. We really want to change the adage that money is the noun or the destination. Money is simply a tool that you use to take you somewhere you want to go. And what the objective of financial freedom is that retirement has kind of gone extinct. This idea that we're going to work to 65 and then a pension, Social Security, or something else is going to take care of us is gone. We have to get to this idea that we are now using money to support a lifestyle, both while we're working and then while we're not working. And that's what true freedom gets to. But the idea that it's called your money vehicle is that each and every person who gets a copy accepts this notion that they have just sat down in the driver's seat of their money vehicle, their tool that is going to take them on this journey. No longer do we sit in a train and have our company or a corporation take us where we want to go. It is up to us to get the driving, you know, the driver's wheel and start to steer in. So that is truly what the book began out of, is as I was traveling in the NFL, you get handed big paychecks. You know, it used to be whatever your salary was divided by 17, and you get that check each week. If you do that math, you know, I sat next to guys who were making $17 million, and yeah, they were getting $1 million a week. And that's a humbling, humbling thing to see them open those kinds of checks. But my first big check came and went. And, you know, I looked at and I woke up a night or two later in sweat and in cramps and just in anxiety. And I realized, like, if I was going to handle this NFL opportunity that way, I was just going to end up another statistic that everybody points to. And it was not the true dream. So I started to educate myself. And as that journey continued, I realized more and more, not only did I love being empowered around my own financial future, but I love telling people about it. And so it started in the locker room when guys would ask, hey, what's the 401k and, you know, stuff around NFL benefits. Then it went to my brothers, who are very highly educated, but had no understanding around money. And eventually it got to, well, how could I teach more and more people? And that came to writing a book. And taking the book and being able to create video content, virtual content, podcast content, because today's day and age, not everybody wants to sit and read a book. And so it's just been a really neat adaptation of my journey and what I've been able to learn through that experience, as well as what I think everybody needs to wake up and realize: financial empowerment is no longer a questionable need in your repertoire. It is a necessary skill of survival in today's day and age.
Yeah. Now, Jed, you're not just a athlete that took a finance class. You're a certified financial planner, worked for Bright & Jones.
Yeah.
You've built a great brand for yourself post-NFL in taking this.
Thank you.
Have any active players reached out to you for guidance? What's your cadence?
Oh, yeah. So that's what's been the most humbling and encouraging part. You know, I left a company, Bright & Jones, great registered RIA, registered investment advisor, making big noise, doing great things in the space. But why I left was I wanted to be able to focus strictly on the educational part and not have I don't want to say muddied water, but people would always associate, well, Jed's just talking to an NFL player, so he becomes a client. Like, there, that's the lead in there. And since I've got to separate and go out on my own, the NFL has really started to open up their doors. And I'm getting to deliver to 5 or 6 teams this offseason. I'm starting to deliver to some Major League Baseball groups, some student athlete, some athletic departments across the country. And so as I look at it, especially with all this craziness going on around COVID-19, one of the big hurdles for me was, well, Jed can't be in 32 NFL teams. He can't go and travel like that. Now it's the click of a button. And I got to deliver to the Detroit Lions twice last week. I'm getting to deliver to the Seahawks this week, the Colts and the Rams here coming up next week. And I look at, well, one, does that trust tree get built in one session? Absolutely not. But that's what I lead with. Hey, I was in your shoes. I know I don't want to trust some guy coming in here talking about money. Here are just 3 or 4 questions I asked myself while I was sitting there. Which ones do you guys want me to answer? And that question alone puts the ownership on them. Hey, here's A, B, C, or D. Answer C for me. Okay, boom, let's go there. I don't want to have a PowerPoint. I don't want to feel like Morgan Stanley, suit and tie, talking at you. I want it to be real. I want it to be stories so I can simplify subjects. And then I want to leave this session with one thing. One thing you know you got to go do, because if I just simply sit and talk and educate, it's a great thing, but it is not what I'm after. I'm after impact and behavioral change. So if I can talk to a group of 20 rookies and 5 of them actually go and do one of the objectives that we talked about, whether it's around cash management, insurance, taxes, investing, whatever the topic, if they did one thing, it was worth my time and it was worth their time. So I see this time and space. I really appreciate you talking about the branding element. Man, that has been such a new journey and such a grinding daily thing. That saying of it takes 10,000 hours to create a brand and 10 seconds to ruin one, you know, it's just real. So that is what I'm really trying to continue to beat the drum on is, I am a former player. I have this message and I'm hoping you can trust me, because before me, there's been some former players with a message that have taken advantage and burned some bridges. So now I'm trying to repair a lot as I go forward.
It's apparent Jedzilla, as they called him, is passionate about finances, but let's take him back to his playing days as a Coug and a Saint right now with our West Coast swing.
We got some questions that hopefully will bring up some memories. And if you believe they will ruin your brand, you can plead the fifth.
I'm good at pivoting.
All right, good. Placed Will Dirting at linebacker your freshman year at one point. Will was an interesting guy. Give us your best story about Will.
Legend. So I got to Washington State not being a drinker. I'd only drank once, and it was the end of my senior year. So my first experience with Will Dirting is he had overalls on. First off, I'm an Orange County kid, not a lot of overalls walking around, but one strap on, no shirt, and was just walking around with a bottle of not Idaho, it was BV.
Black Velvet.
Black Velvet. And was just taking it from the bottle. And in that moment, I realized, like, this is the dude I'm trying to replace. Like, he just has whatever it is. And I don't think I have that. I also am not fast, so that helped into it. But I mean, a guy from Okanagan, he was a living legend. And the story I always heard is he had to ride a bike to just go get a phone to actually have his recruiting calls. I always loved those. But no, Will was one of those guys, man, who was just a natural love of the game. And then came to a position where his love kind of ran out. And injury does that to players, not being able to play at the same level he once could, maybe. But in the college game, he was every bit as the, I don't want to say unquestionable, but not supposed to be out there, dominant force. Yeah. And it was truly neat to watch him overcome whatever physical things he had to be out on the field and to be a true great player.
I can picture him in that those overalls and BVs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Standing outside the Coug.
So at Washington State, you scored your first touchdown against Stanford. I believe it was at Stanford. Oh, what was the offensive formation and what was the play?
So first off, it was at Stanford. I think it was their first home game in their new stadium. And it was in front of arguably 2,000 fans, most of which were Cougars, and the Stanford fans were definitely reading books. It was a wing formation, which meant I was the offset tight end, and we were it was a play action, so it was a run play against us. You block down on the end for a three count, and then as the quarterback bootlegged back, I got to spin off and ended up being pretty much wide open, so it was just one of those don't drop it's. But my family being a SoCal, they were up in the stands, so I kind of get to blow them a kiss and point and share the love. It was pretty cool, and it was a good Pac-12 win, Pac-10 win.
Jed, nine players from the 2016 touched the NFL at some point, so that was your junior year. Was there any one player in particular that you said, this guy's got it?
Jerome Harrison. Unquestioned, the ghost, man. JC, Jerome Harrison, one. My junior year, I didn't play much tight end because we had Troy Bieniemy and Cody Boyd, and Jesse Taylor some. So what I did was I was called the fullback. We didn't have a fullback, so you can call me whatever the heck. I was, I guess, a backup long snapper too. But I roomed with Jerome, and he was leading the nation in rushing. And at one, Washington State, we were not a running organization. It was just his pure talent. He was the ghost because nobody could hit him. And he had his best plays in spring ball and in training camp, where you just saw him demoralize our defense as the Cougar defense, untouched and making four or five guys miss on a play and then just skirting free. And we were all like, is he going to be able to do that? Like when we get to Pac-10? And yeah, he did. Could the rest of us meet his level? Not all the time. And truly some injuries disrupted that team. But Jerome was one of those guys that you just loved, you know, a tiny little running back, and would put 405 on the squat rack and just do it out of spite because somebody said he couldn't do it. And then you go next to Jerome and a guy named Rupati Patoyatua, who is the opposite. He was 6'8", 300 pounds naturally. And you stand next to Rapati and you go, yeah, somebody's going to find a place for this guy on their defensive unit. And go figure, he went and ended up playing 8 or 9 years and got a few M's and did actually a really, really good job of capturing the dream.
So 2004 through 2006, I'm going to call it the Pac-10's heyday. It was loaded with talent top to bottom.
Yes, it was.
In your opinion, who was the best player that you played against during your time at Washington State?
Oh, man. Well, this is poetic. We started out talking about him. My first time on ESPN SportsCenter, the number one play of the week, with Reggie Bush making me run in a little circle and kind of looking at me and laughing. I brought it up to him when I got to New Orleans, and he kind of was like, yeah, you know, you got to be more specific. but no doubt, man, Reggie was the most electric player in college football. And we, growing up in Southern California, growing up near the Palmer family, Carson Palmer and his younger brother Jordan was my quarterback. I saw USC's rise and I saw them begin to take dominance and shape. They had a semi-pro team and they had a head coach who now we can all say is just a great head coach. At the time, it was like, man, how is Pete Carroll doing this? But you realize there is something to getting a room full of young men to believe in something bigger than themselves. He's always been able to do that. But to watch, you know, the Lendale White thunder and lightning, it was lightning, man. Reggie was scary. Reggie was so good. You had to, your game, only game plan was, how do we get the ball out of his hands? And the moments you didn't, we had a punt and he ran around all of us, including me, and it made me look very silly. I should probably get that clip, but he was one of those guys that the team had a mystique. They walked from their bus when they arrived in Pullman through our walkthrough onto the 50-yard line of the Cougar logo, and as a linebacker corps just stood and looked at us. We were like, these guys are another level, man. Like, what? We're in the middle of practice. But then to have a talent, you know, Matt Leinart's great, blah. Reggie Bush was amazing. And I don't know if there's been another player. Maybe Saquon Barkley was young, like Reggie-ish. But I don't think there's been another player that it was as electric as Reggie is.
Jed, don't know if you're aware of this. 2007, you were the last team to actually win the Apple Cup in Seattle.
Wow, that's depressing.
It is a little depressing for
that's
a poop.
Very
what
depressing.
What did you do to celebrate that night?
So truly, I was hurt and I was sick, so I didn't do much. We took pride in it. We were really excited about it. We were hoping it was going to salvage a season, and it really didn't. But it was one of those things. By your senior year, growing up in California, I wasn't a big Apple Cup guy. But by my senior year, I knew what it was and what it meant. And to give the Cougar Nation the point of pride, the trophy, it meant a lot more than a good party. We had good parties after every game, win or lose. But it was the pride of, like, for a lot of people, that's a successful year. Beat the Dogs. It was good. It's a winning season. And so that was really neat. And as this last decade has unfolded, we realize how precious and special it was. And hopefully we can start to flip that back around.
Rolo.
Yeah.
How would you describe the atmosphere during a college football game in Pullman to a Saints fan?
Similar. They have the same state of mind, which means they showed up for a party. The elements can be different. Obviously, it gets a lot colder because it's outdoors. But truly, the passion is very similar. It is not the biggest venue. Neither is it was the Mercedes-Benz. Neither is the Superdome. But it has that feel of the diehards are there because they're passionate about their team and supporting it. So I think, and I always said, a Cougar will fit very nicely into New Orleans. Good, fun-loving people put a drink in their hand. They just want to have a good time. I got to walk into New Orleans behind a Washington State legend of Steve Gleason. And so having that kind of like connectivity of like, wait, Washington State. Oh, Steve. I was like, yeah, that's the Washington State. So that always made New Orleans an immediate acceptance for me. But yeah, I think a who dat comes to Pullman, goes to some of the tailgates beforehand. They'll be singing the fight song by halftime.
Jed, you recently stated that one of the reasons you signed with WSU because it was the first place you drank.
Mm-hmm.
What was it?
So it was my recruiting trip. And honestly, I ended up canceling my other recruiting trips after that. One, because it was such a great time. But two, I would have had to miss some basketball games my senior year. And we ended up winning CIF. So it turned out to be a good decision. But that was, you know, one of those experiences. It was when I met Will Durding. And seeing that, you know, idea of like, whoa, this is a whole different ball game. But it was just that idea of everybody was safe. Everybody was happy. Everybody was having a heck of a time. And it could not have been further in my mind than Orange County, California. And I liked that there was something that drew me to that. And also, I mean, while I was there, they beat UCLA. We beat UCLA and we're a top 10 team. So that all kind of played into, you know, why am I not going there? I had a pretty good time on my trip, and it's a good football school.
So I do have a question, but you brought up a good point. Now I have a clarifying question. So Jordan Palmer was your quarterback in high school, and then was Mark Sanchez on the team too?
So Mark came the year after. So okay. Jordan was my sophomore year. Mark was my senior year. In between, we had a guy named Marty Tabin, who wasn't actually a quarterback, but was probably the best of the three high school quarterbacks. He was an athlete. But yeah, we had some, I mean, Mission Viejo, you look at the USC like run, Mission Viejo had a run very similar. I went 41-0 and then lost my very last game. So I ended up 41-1. Mark then the next year went undefeated. So we were a powerhouse. And yeah, Jordan, man, I just got to interview Jordan for my podcast that's coming out. He has been one of those characters that has just continually, you know, been given an inch and takes them and creates a mile with it. And he did it throughout his career. He's done it as an entrepreneur now. Now he's doing it as a trainer and a coach. But yeah, we look at Mission Viejo Hall of Fame. Is Jed Collins the winningest? Sure, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about fame here. In the 4 years around me, we put no less than 30 guys into Division I football, which is astounding for a public Southern Orange County high school.
Yeah. So I believe Mark played basketball and football as well. Who would win in a game of horse? You or Mark?
So Jordan and Mark both played on our basketball team. I would probably put played in quotations. I was the CIF player of the year. I would friggin' kill both of those guys. And they would admit it handedly without question. I was really good at basketball, oddly enough. But my family was all basketball. Both my brothers went and played D1. My dad was drafted in the NBA, ABA. I was the odd duck, but they're also all 6'5", 6'6". I was 6'1". So football, my high school coach, Bob Johnson, changed my life. He's a legendary high school quarterback guru. And he sat me down my sophomore year, was like, son, where exactly do you think you're going for basketball? Here's some cleats, go out to practice. All right.
I love it. And now we'll make the transition back to football and finances with Jed. Got your first active paycheck from the Browns and said you immediately spent it on before even opening it.
Yeah.
What'd you spend it on?
So it's a cute story. I bought an engagement ring. My wife, Kira, and I, who, Ben, you know, we're still married after 10 plus years. So a wise investment, it turned out to be, yes. But, and I will say this to her face, you know, my first check came and went. That is not how you should handle money. But it woke me up to the identification that, one, I was uneducated on money, but two, I was a spender. I saw money in the day-to-day time frame. We all are. You're born into a spender. Some people have parents who teach them a little bit about money and they become savers and say, well, I don't want to just go buy this one thing. I want to, you know, save up and go get something in 6 months or a year. And you see money in a year-to-year frame. But what my course, what my message is around is this secret of the wealthy, where you go from spender to saver to investor. And then you don't look at money day to day. You don't even look at money year to year. Money becomes a decade to decade thing. And for the first time in your phase of life, you stop just going to work for money and you start having money work for you. And that message has been lost amongst everyone outside of the 1% of the wealthy class. And it's not overnight. It's not easy. But you put $100, $500, $5,000 into an account and let it go to work for you and don't look at it for 10 years, I guarantee it's going to have gone up. And that's where I want to begin to, and it's no different than an NFL rookie. Man, how can I get you to see this 3 or 4 year career is supposed to set up the next 30 or 40 years? That's a challenge, man. That's a very big challenge. So you got to give them parameters, but more importantly, you got to show them the story of why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. So, Jed, I want to take our listeners into a time in your career when you were with the Saints. Mm. So I read where you joined them after their Super Bowl championship.
Great time.
In 2010. What was it like playing with Drew Brees?
Oh, man. So first, I actually had this memory the other day because somebody asked me about him. But Sean Payton, the first meeting I was in the year after they'd won the Super Bowl, he gets up there and one of his first statements is like, you know what I love about being a world champion? Sure, we all got a pay raise. Sure, we all got sweet rings. But how many of us went and got prettier wives? And he points to one of the guys in the front row and is like, this guy, one of our ugly defensive ends linemen, like this guy's wife is gorgeous. And look how ugly this mother is. I just always loved, like I was on the other side of the wave. The parade was over, but the energy and the buzz was still there. Drew Brees is one of those cats. And in my rookie to veteran workshops, I have an entire segment dedicated to him. He is twice the man he is a football player, and he is 10 times the leader. He's the kind of guy who has, you know, Coach Wooden's pyramid in his locker because he studies it on a daily basis. He's the kind of guy who's habitual about every process of his life because he realizes to repeat success, you have to build out routines. You have to build out habits. And he, you know, oddly enough, football players, you don't think get philosophical, but he would go Aristotle on you and say, you are what you repeatedly do. I would be in practice 20 years of football. He's still the only quarterback I ever saw do this. Every day, every drill, Drew would throw the ball to his first read, whether it was one-on-one, seven-on-sevens, team, full live, in whatever it was. He would throw the ball to his first read, and then his hands, his eyes, and his feet would track to his second, his third, and his fourth read, and then kind of giving a glance down to the check down. I noticed it because I was the check down guy, and the ball never ended up coming to me. But I would watch this system and this repetition, and it was that mindset, that idea that he wanted to, in the game, have that be a habit, have that be unconscious. I don't want to know where my second progression is. I want it to be an instinct so I can then read the defense. Then I can adapt. Then I can pivot, all focusing on the reward. And the reward was a first down, a touchdown, whatever it was. But Drew was one of those guys. And if you watch some of the players that have retired from the Saints, and as you watch his reputation through the league, he is somebody you want to emulate on a day-to-day basis. He is somebody who makes you better by solely focusing on himself. And I got to watch this Last Dance, as we all did. It was phenomenal. And it was Michael Jordan holding himself to this standard and challenging everyone to try to meet that level. Drew, I don't know if he will be seen in the same level of greatness, but he is going to be one of the greatest football players. Held that same tier, but instead of challenging you, he simply encouraged you to follow his lead, and he did it by example. And so there was this, you know, Machiavellian question of, is it better to be respected or feared? Michael Jordan was feared. Guy is the GOAT, greatest of all time. I think Tom Brady is feared. I don't think you want to mess up for Tom. Drew, on the other hand, you will run the wrong route and he will bring you back and tell you why he needs to do better. And you just look him in the eye and you're just, okay, man, I want to hug you and then I want to go get better for you. So it was just that different respect level.
So 2011, he had a career year. I think a lot of it is attributed because you were in the backfield.
I 90% of it.
But he threw for 5,400 yards, 43 touchdowns, I believe. Mm-hmm. What was the most memorable part of the 2011 season for you?
Well, I would say rushing for 135 yards a game on average, but that obviously gets muted. Well, why we were such, and we were the best offense of all time at the time, why is because I added a dimension, and we say it jokingly, it wasn't the only dimension. We also added Darren Sproles. That added a completely different element. That was Jimmy Graham's first year of really breaking out. And so you look at those three weapons on top of the fact that they already had Pierre Thomas and Mark Ingram. Actually, Mark came that year too, but Marcus Colston and Lance Moore. So what they already had going, and then you throw in these different dynamics, what made us so unique was we were unstoppable in a way. We believed that, but the biggest memory was going into each game knowing we could score 30 plus points. And most of the games we did, we got beat in San Francisco on a fluke game because our running backs got all knocked out. You know, we had about six guys on IR. Pierre Thomas, the first drive, fumbled on the 2-yard line and got knocked unconscious and out of the game. Darren Sproles got hurt that game. And so why we got limited was because our personnel got limited, and that, you know, is a story for another day. But that 2011 season, I'll never forget the play that we broke the record. It went to Darren, and I was standing wide open in the flat. He just he didn't that progression never got all the way over to me. So it was just one of those things, but it is a lifelong energy that once you are amongst greatness, once you taste it and experience it, much like the Super Bowl, and this is what they always say, is the biggest curse is going to the Super Bowl once, because you know you're always going to want to go back and you never know if you're going to. That 2011 team and season was a beautiful mashup of how to highlight new, how to not be ego enough to say we're not going to change part of our offense because we have new talent. You have to do that. And the Saints are notorious for it, as opposed to a lot of other organizations, is I beat out a guy they traded for and gave money. Jimmy beat out, you know, a guy they were paying. Pierre Thomas is a undrafted cat who beat out third rounder his rookie year. You know, they were willing to make those kind of decisions for best case scenario on the field, not best case scenario salary cap wise. And that's what why they've been able to produce for so long, is they continually let players overplay their, you know, opportunity and continue to be creative with their personnel.
So you mentioned Sean Payton and his sense of humor early on, but he's also considered one of the brightest minds in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what he's like during a film section?
So being a head coach in the NFL is an extremely challenging responsibility. I say this jokingly, and it is meant to, but it is also very true. You have to believe and have the ego of the biggest, baddest dude in the room. I, as a player, need to trust that come crunch time, whatever decision you make, I'm going to follow it. And I'm going to blindly or convincingly understand that this was the right and best decision for the team. So he definitely had that ego that it is an arrogance, but it's just a confidence in himself that he believed, you know, his stuff was not going to lose games. If we did lose, it was obviously the defense's fault. Like, that was just his standard stance. But what you loved about it was, again, you look at the Saints offense, and most people call plays. Everybody calls plays. New Orleans was one of the first places that said, well, how do we beat a team before we even get to what we're going to do? Let's look at who is going to be running it. And they were the first group to have 40 plus personnel groups. You know, they needed a grouping that had me and Darren Sproles. And then they needed Darren Sproles and Jimmy. But then they needed Jimmy and Darren, but in different spots of the formation for different plays. And all of those are predetermined and pre-designed. And so running out on the field was always like, let's catch them by surprise. And if you notice, especially in timeouts, but really anytime they're changing personnel groups, there's always a big clump of them because the defense has to then adapt and change. Jimmy Graham runs on the field. You need to bring in a different group than if Jed Collins runs on the field. And so that's what made his mastery, was not just saying this play is designed to beat this coverage. It was breaking it down to, all right, we're going against this defense. Who do we want to attack and who are we going to attack them with? And okay, we're going to play the New York Jets. They got shut down corners. All right, let's take their nickel. Let's put it one play. He's guarding a 6'7" behemoth. And the next, next play, he's guarding a 5'5" jackrabbit. Like, good luck. Yeah. And you loved that chess strategy. And one of the examples I love to use is this idea from checkers to chess. Chess is professional football. We no longer just were trying to run things and move the ball down the field. You are now thinking of plays and thinking of who's going to run them. And then we're running plays, not even necessarily for that play, but for two series from now, we're going to run an oddly similar play. And then we're going to trick it and dip it. And we're going to get the big chunk that we're actually going for. And that was the beauty of diving into their offense, was seeing the chess strategy from beginning to end and seeing it come to fruition time and time again.
So in 2013, you guys played the Patriots, and Peyton and Belichick are friends, and Belichick's a great mind. What did Belichick try to do to slow you guys down on offense?
So one thing you learn is in Foxborough, you do not bring any physical playbooks. You don't have any paper. And even in the hotel meeting rooms, we'd always play music because people would think, hey, somebody's listening. And with a home record like they have at home, somebody is listening. Somebody's doing something. So what they did is they continued with the chess strategy, man. And that's what's so beautiful is they looked at a, you know, at that time, their defense was not their strength. At that time, they took a questionable defense and decided who was going to beat us. And each and every time you were able to put Drew or somebody in a box and try to confuse them, that's what they did so well, was they confused, they hid coverages, they use and spotlight their advantages to an extreme. But ultimately, it would just come down to, I would say, an energy in that building that it was who had the last ball. And I think I went in there three times as a Saint. I went in there once as a Lion. And every time we would score with a few minutes left and be winning. And this unnerving feel of like that guy is on the other sideline. And I think he plays to moments. And those were the moments he wanted to always know, Drew, you're not going to beat me in my house.
Yeah. So last question. This is a bonus question. You were the backup long snapper for the Saints. Oh, yeah. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And so many people don't know, you might not know this, Jed. Ben was a backup long snapper in high school. So if Ben wants to get back into the game and make himself available as a long snapper for the Seahawks, what kind of advice would you give him?
First off, don't give up hope. secondly, be perfect.
I think it's like this, right, Jed?
Yeah, there you go.
Little snap.
Flick the wrist, man, and hyperextend the elbows. So one of my good buddies is Don Muehlbach, who is going into his 19th season, 18th or 19th season as the Detroit Lions long snapper.
Oh, wow.
It's incredible. Mule would not have played on my high school team. and he will self-admittedly say that. But he is a perfectionist. He is an amazing creature of habit, but he's also an amazing creature of self-driven motivation. And that's what it takes to be a long snapper is you have to be afraid that you are going to mess up every snap, and you have to treat each rep with that kind of intentionality. There was a moment where I wasn't making it as a fullback, and I looked at how many skills can I have to stop from getting cut. And then there was even a spot where I got a workout as a long snapper for the Saints, oddly enough, while I was on practice squad. I won that workout, oddly enough, and they ended up going with the guy that had actually snapped in games, go figure. But it was one of those things. I wish I would have transitioned earlier and given it the real benefit of the doubt, because I think I could have played a lot longer. Fullback's a grueling spot. But the idea that we should have all learned the language of money going into college the same way every football player who is not a star should learn to long snap, because it is one of those things that some game is going to come to. You need to snap a field goal or you need to get off a punt to go win the game, and your guy has a broken arm or your guy's knocked unconscious or whatever it is. It's a tremendous quality and skill. And it is the only reason I got picked up in Tennessee when I was down there, is because they had a veteran guy and they're like, hey, we need to have somebody to take reps off of him at long snapper, not fullback. Okay. And it is a unique thing. It is also a funny thing, because people are like, oh, it's a super easy skill. And it's like, no, man, you got a 6-inch by 6-inch box, and you got to put it 14 yards in the air under 0.75 seconds. It's a skill, and that's why I look at Mule, and literally the last 8-7 seasons I've known him, he calls me each August, and it's like, they brought in a young guy to take my job, and I'm like, they absolutely should. He's not going to until you're ready to be done, but he every year freaks out and has the same, but that's why he's still there.
Thanks for coming on. Tell our fans where they can find you, where they can One, your book. What else you got coming? Where they can find your podcast? Anything on social media? Wrap it up for us.
I love it. First off, appreciate this. Always enjoy. This was fun. So JedediahCollins.com. Come check me out. My podcast is going to be Rookie to Veteran. That's going to launch actually here next week. And Your Money Vehicle is the book. The online course will come out here this summer. You can go to yourmoneyvehicle.com/go and get access to the book, the course, and everything that we're pushing out and creating. But as you guys are, I am just a young entrepreneur, a new brand, trying to continue to put out my message and to have people kind of hear it and think it's worthwhile. So thank you for the platform and the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jed. WST_podcast on all your social media. You can find us on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcast. Jed, thanks for coming on. Happy Memorial Day. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Hey, same to you guys.
All right, take care.